You're listening to TIP.
Real estate resonated with me because I knew I could control what I bought it for, roughly what financing terms I could get, what I would rent it out for, whether I renovated it or not, whether I sold. All those sort of things was my decision.
Hey, everybody. In today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with Alan Corey, a self-described real estate maximalist who's achieved financial independence through a long-term, straightforward real estate strategy. You also learn about his life as a New York comic, how Alan practiced habits of the wealthy to build his portfolio, how he got his start as an author, what holds people back from getting started in real estate, the importance of finding your niche and sticking with it, and a whole lot more. Alan is a real estate investing mentor and coach, an Atlanta realtor, and owns a large portfolio of multifamily properties. He's also the author of A Million Bucks by 30 and House Fire, and runs House Money Media. Alan has a unique perspective on how to apply the 4% rule to real estate, which I found really useful. He's also just led a super interesting life, which you'll hear all about. Without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with Alan Corey.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly, and joining me in the studio today is Mr. Alan Corey. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Patrick. Excited to get started.
I'm happy to have you on. I listened to two of your interviews you did with my colleague, Robert, maybe a couple years back, but you've got a pretty interesting story and background, not just what you're up to now, but in your early days that I wanted to hear more about and learn about. Talk to me about after college, moving to New York City and what your steps were initially when you moved into New York City. You've got some pretty funny stories, I think.
Yeah, well, I moved to New York and I had no connections and I didn't know what I was doing. And it was the most expensive city in town. So I found the cheapest place I could possibly do to find a rent. And it was an illegal sublet in the Spanish Harlem project. So I was paying $400 a month to stay in the projects. And, you know, this is how naive I was. I didn't even know it was the projects. I was living there for about 9 months and everyone, I couldn't figure out why people wouldn't come over and visit me. And they're like, we just feel unsafe. You live in the projects. And I was like, I do. And I just thought it was New York City living, but that's all I could afford. And that's how I could live in New York. And the reason I wanted to go to New York is I thought my path to riches and wealth, which was important to me coming out of college, I was like, this is what I got to do as an adult, was to be an entertainer of some sort. Because in my head, it's like, if you're an entertainer, you make a lot of money. And I couldn't sing, I couldn't dance, I couldn't act, I couldn't do anything. So I was like, well, I might as well try stand-up comedy. And I got that confidence because I was the class clown. And I'm here to tell you, just because you're the class clown of your high school doesn't mean you cut out for comedy, but I still enjoyed it. I did it for about 5 years in New York City and found a tech support job to pay the bills during the day. And then I was in the comedy clubs at night. And, you know, it was fun. It was actually a way to save money because instead of me paying for entertainment, I was the entertainment. Sort of the similar strategy on social media is, you know, you can either consume content on social media or you can be the provider of content and get paid for it from now and then. So kind of wiped out my entertainment budget by being the entertainment. And I didn't have a car. I took the bus and subway everywhere. And then I lived in the project. So those are the three big sort of financial hurdles that everyone has. And I was able to save some money and get into real estate eventually.
So tell me more about that. When you were in college, were you doing stand-up or did you just go kind of cold turkey into New York saying, I'm going to make it and jumped right in?
My real dream was to be a comedy writer. That's what I wanted to do. So I wrote some sketch shows and comedy, you know, things in college. And a touring comic, David Tell, came through Atlanta. And I talked to him after the show and I said, listen, I just want to be a comedy writer. And he told me, move to New York City and do stand up and then people will hire you to write for them. And so I was like, oh, that's my career plan. Let me do that. And so that's why I started doing more and more stand up just to get more exposure of my writing.
It's got to be such a tough gig, I would imagine. I mean, you've got to handle rejection, and I imagine you developed a pretty tough hide that you could then apply to real estate later on. Was that the case?
It's a combination because the people who are attracted to comedy, they just want the limelight. They want to be on stage. They want like that's the dopamine hits when you are like having a great show are so high that you're completely fine bombing 9 times in a row to get that high of the, you know, the one that just kills. And then also in New York City, like people are in the subway, like cutting their fingernails and brushing their teeth because you're like, I'm never going to see these people ever again. And so it's the same sort of way when you're on stage, whoever's there, it's like, if I embarrass myself, I'm never going to see these people ever again. It doesn't matter, you know, kind of thing. So you trick your mind into having little safety nets of your ego just in case things go south.
Yeah, it's a good way to look at it. You also did, I just found this out too, that you got involved in some reality TV shows. How did that happen? And tell me more about that.
Yeah, so this was early 2000, pre-YouTube, pre-social media, and sort of the formula at the time, if you were going to make a reality TV show, is that you would go cast the male roles from comedy clubs because they were comfortable on camera and ideally provide some sort of entertainment. And then they would cast the women parts from the modeling agencies. And so I got a lot of opportunities to be on stand-up or on reality TV, mainly through being a stand-up comedian. I also did improv at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. So that sort of fed into reality TV. I'm a terrible actor. And so I could just basically play a buffoon version of myself, or what my wife would probably say is myself on reality TV. And, you know, I got on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I got made over on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I was on Jerry Springer, the restaurant with Rocco Dispirito. I was one of the waiters, a couple dating shows, a game show, you know. And so it was just, it was fun. It became a hobby for me.
So like you said, it's entertainment, but I wanted to hear a little bit more. You're working at this tech support job, it sounded like, for 40 grand. You're doing the stand-up, you know, comedy stuff in the evenings. Talk to me when you first started practicing some of these financial habits that you started to start really saving money, and some of the habits that you had a tweet that I saw about 6 things that you copied from wealthy people. So I wanted to talk about just some of the things that you did that people could do today that really worked for you to start saving up a nest egg.
Yeah, I got to New York and I realized like it was the first time I'd really seen like wealthy people, you know, people taking the cab. I was like, oh my God, how do they get in? They afford a cab like that? Like, I want to be that rich one day kind of thing. So I didn't have any mentors. I didn't have any like network connections at all. Like, you know, people who are making in New York seemed to come from Ivy League backgrounds. My parents were public school teachers and I was just on my own. And so I went to the library every day because, again, this was pre-YouTube podcast. And so I got every single book I could in the business section about stocks and, you know, IRAs and real estate and wealth building, personal finance, because I knew none of this. And I was like, I don't have any mentors. I've got to learn on my own. And so then I did start thinking about who were the richest people in my life. And there were two of my basketball coaches who I admired them. One, because I loved basketball growing up, but two, they never wore a suit and tie. They always were able to make the afternoon practices and coach, and all the other parents were working. And it seemed like every story they shared, they were on the golf course. And I was like, oh, you know, everything I thought it meant to be rich, where you have to wear like a power suit and you go get, you know, a Ivy League education. My mentors, when I look back, I didn't realize they were my mentors at the time, but they were small business owners. They were real estate investors. And so I was like, oh, I think I could do that. And after reading all these books, I realized anything having to do with stocks, I felt like it was a 30-year horse race, almost like a gamble where, yeah, it makes sense. I'm looking at numbers in a paper and let's invest in it, but I have no control. Like, right. I can't shake the neck of the CEO and tell him to change things to make his company better. But real estate, I felt like I had control. Like if I bought a property and my goal was just to buy one property a year for 5 straight years, I thought that would be enough for me to retire, but at least leave my day job so that I could focus on comedy full time. And so that was my plan. And so it just, real estate resonated with me because I knew I could control what I bought it for, roughly what financing terms I could get, what I would rent it out for, whether I renovated it or not, whether I sold, all those sort of things was my decision. So I felt like, and I wasn't going to let myself down when it came to money. So that's sort of, I zeroed in on real estate.
I feel the same way. My first love was actually the stock market. But as I got older, I came to the same conclusion as I have way more control in real estate. Exactly all the reasons you pointed out. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about, I want to talk about your first investment, your real estate investment. But prior to that, you were living pretty extreme. You were living on $40,000 a year. It doesn't sound like you were making much income from the reality TV shows or the comedy. Talk to me a little about how you saved up for your initial down payment for your first purchase.
Yeah, way to rub it in that I made no money from comedy. But yes, you're correct. It was a terrible comment, but I often had to pay to get up on stage. That's how bad I was. So I had a $48,000 salary. I went to the HR person who handled the direct deposits. And I said, listen, I need you to put 50% in this bank account, which is the one I use every single day, which is the ATM right outside the office. And then I need you to put 50% of my income in this bank that's across town on the other side of Manhattan. Really tough to get to. This is pre-online banking days and all that too. So I physically had to go there. I threw away the ATM card. I just didn't want to have access to it. And so that, and then I just spent whatever. I didn't feel like I had to save or invest anything. I just spent whatever was in my day-to-day account, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but that got really lean. You know, sure, I was paying $400 a month in the projects, but I wanted to be even leaner. And so I went to the bodega, bought at the time ramen noodles in bulk. And if I got like a 36 pack, they ended up being about 13 cents each. And so I ate those every day for lunch. I'd go to the bakery right before it closed where they were throwing out that day's fresh baked bagels and bread. And they would sometimes give it to me for free or at least 50% off. Or, you know, I'm like, listen, I know you're going to throw these away. And they're like, fine, Alan, you know, they got whatever. They got to know me pretty well. And so I just sort of, you know, now they call this lean fire. I didn't know it at the time, but it was fine. Like none of my friends had money. I lived in the projects. I wasn't, you know, showy. I was taking the bus everywhere. So it was just part of my lifestyle to just have a little bit extra money. So, you know, my goal was every January 1st, I would make that trek across Manhattan to that other bank account. And whatever I had saved up there, I would use as a down payment on a property. And so my first year of saving, my first year of a job, I was 21 years old. I had $10,000 saved. And so I was like, okay, that's a 10% down payment on a $100,000 property. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I found one property in all of New York City that was actually listed for $110,000. And this was right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's always fear in the newspaper. Don't buy real estate now. Get out of New York City. This is the dumbest thing you can do, which, you know, now I'm 25 years into real estate investing. That's when you want to buy is when everyone's fearful. But I negotiated them down from $110,000 to $100,000. This is a Brooklyn apartment. I actually got for $99,600, a one bedroom, one bath. I'd never been to Brooklyn at the time. And I know people are thinking like, oh, it must be nice that you bought a property for $100,000 in Brooklyn. It doesn't matter when you buy real estate. It always feels expensive. Definitely expensive for me. But I don't care. I've never been to Brooklyn. I made an offer on it. And I was like, what's the worst that could happen is if this doesn't work out, I live in the projects again. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm used to living in the projects. It was like, I felt like I had such asymmetrical upside if I just, you know, my plan was to buy this property and I turned it into a two bedroom. And I loosely say two bedroom. I just took a heavy curtain, put it, you know, siphoned off my living room and rented that out to another friend of mine who covered my mortgage. They call this now house hacking. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was like, oh, wow, I just bought a property with my $10,000. And now I'm saving. I was spending $400. Now I'm spending nothing on my property because I have a roommate who's paying. And then it just clicked. And I was like, okay, I'm onto something. I just need to do this once a year. Let me save up again. That whole 50% thing, let me save another 50% and see, you know, next January 1st, how much money do I have? And I had $15,000 the next one. And so then I bought a duplex. It was 2-3 bedrooms, duplexes on each side, so 6 bedrooms. I moved in and rented it to 5 comedians. We called it the House of Clowns. And then there, that paid all my mortgage, as well as an extra $2,000 on top of that profit, which was more than my take-home pay at my day job. So right. I could have left my day job after my second purchase, but you know, sacrifices, you know, Brooklyn at the time, it was on Myrtle Avenue, which they called Murder Avenue. People were always stop me and say, are you a cop? Are you living here? Did you move here because you're a police officer? And I was like, do you want me to be a cop? Like, what's the right answer? Like what's safest for me? Right. Like, yes, I'm a cop or no, I'm a cop. Like, yeah. I don't know how to answer you. And they're like, oh, then you're definitely a cop. And I'm like, okay, I can't win. So I lived in places that you look like a genius if you invest in real estate and wait. Real estate is not get rich quick. It's get rich eventually.
So was that your strategy going into it, this house hacking idea? I mean, house hacking really wasn't a thing, I don't think, or maybe it was a thing, but it wasn't called house hacking at the time you were doing it, right?
No, I think Brandon Turner, of Bigger Pockets fame, coined house hacking, so kudos to him. What was a thing was being a landlord. And so to me, it made sense. That's what I was trying to be. I was like, if I buy a property and, oh, I owe X amount of dollars, but I charge Y amount of dollars, then I get paid that difference. And I was like, it'll probably take me 5 properties to replace my $40,000 day income after taxes and everything like that. I was already living on $19,000, so roughly $20,000 after the 50-50 split. So then that just made sense. And then what I realized is when I bought that duplex, I could charge, I can make more money if I charge by the room rather by charging for the whole unit. And so, and it was easier for me to charge by the room if I actually lived there as well. And so I took the smallest room that I couldn't rent out. It didn't have any windows. It barely had a closet. I could only fit a twin bed in there and nothing else. And so I was like, okay, I'll live here and I'll rent out the master and the primary bedrooms and for a little bit more money than the rest. And so it was, I wanted to live with my friends anyway, other comedians. So it was a great setup. And the more money that I saw, I was like, it just reiterated, I need to do more of this.
Sure. So it sounded like every January 1st, you would take your savings and make a purchase roughly around, you know, in January sometime. During the rest of the year, were you following the real estate market? Were you keeping an eye on things and kind of a pulse of what was going on? So like when the next January rolled around, you knew or had some idea of like where you wanted to buy or potential deals that you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, I became obsessive about real estate because I was like, this is my path. So far as my path out of the projects. And now this is going to be my path to the wealth. And so blogs were just getting invented. I became the number one submitter of posts and information to new blogs. Blogs were new at the time, to Curbed, brownstoner.com. There was in New York. I was just like, hey, did you know about this? And they're like, Alan, you're our biggest lead source. And I was like, because I was just talking to everyone, wanting to know what was going on. And so I was just obsessed because I was like, this is my path. I don't have the skill set to get paid a big salary. I hated corporate world. It wasn't for me. I just felt like I had to kiss butt to my boss and hope that they give me a raise or give me a new position. Like I just wanted control. I just felt like I only had, there was always a ceiling and I didn't have the pedigree to make it, right? So at least on the time frame I wanted to make it. And so I just kept coming back to real estate and I had all my eggs really in one basket. And that's why I obsessed over it. And it was one of those things where the financial crash happened, the great financial crisis of 2008, 2009. I was so far removed, like I didn't even realize I was on that in the middle of that really. Like sure there's reports, but I didn't have stocks. If anything, real estate became easier for me. I couldn't get loans, but it created a higher demand of renters because fewer and fewer people were interested in buying real estate. They didn't want to buy real estate in New York or they couldn't because they lost their jobs or whatever. And so my properties, sure, let's say my second duplex, I bought it for $450,000 with 10% down, $15,000 of my own money, but also borrowed $30,000 hard money to get it done. But that property, went up to $1 million before the crash in equity. Then it came down to like $300,000. But I didn't care because I wasn't trying to sell. Like it wasn't my primary residence. It was my ATM machine. So I'm like, oh, it actually produced more money. Let me get more of these. And then all the other properties were on discount. So it was easier to buy my third property and easier to buy my fourth property. And funny story about my third property that I bought is I didn't have money because I just finished my second and I wanted to buy it without waiting for a year. So I found a really good deal in a sleepy town that was undiscovered at the time called Red Hook, Brooklyn. And my next door neighbor was a contractor and he didn't have any work because no one had money to hire him to do things. And so I found this deal. And I said, will you renovate it, for free? And then we'll split the equity. And then I knew one person that I thought was rich. I have no idea to this day whether he's rich or not, but he was a lawyer. It was the girl I was dating. Dad, I was like, well, if you're a lawyer in New York City, you must be rich. Like, oh, wow, you went to college and you got a job. Wow, you're a rich person in my life. And I said, well, you can be our third partner. We need the money. But here's the spreadsheet. This is what we can buy it for. This is what we think we can renovate it for. You're just paying for materials because my contractor is going to work for free. Mm-hmm. And this is what we can sell it for. And so we formed a partnership. We bought a building. It was a mixed use, a little bodega storefront at the bottom and 2 apartments up top. It was terrible shape. There was a family living throughout the whole thing, even the storefront. They're using it. It was dangerous to live in. And they knew it was dangerous. And they were asking $600,000. And I was like, guys, we can only make the numbers work if we buy it for $400,000. And so we got them down to $400,000. We bought it, $200,000 in materials to renovate it. And we sold it for $1.1 million. And a year later, and so I think roughly I made $150,000, $160,000 at the end of it. But what was funny is the buyer of that property, my first flip, was Shark Tank's Barbara Corcoran. Bought it for her own personal property.
Really?
It was on the front page of the New York Times. Like Barbara, has discovered Red Hook, Brooklyn, and is making it her own. And that is, I was 25. I just made $150,000. It's like working 3 years as a tech support job, right? And I was like, okay, screw comedy, screw corporate. I'm going all in on real estate. And that was just the confidence boost that I needed. That Barbara Corcoran's buying my properties and I'm 1 year ahead of her and the neighborhoods that I'm looking at and, and all this, like, this is something I should lean into. So I haven't looked back since.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what is happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what is happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I use each morning to kick off my day and stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. All right, back to the show.
So were you doing a mix of buying properties for cash flow and keeping them as rentals, but also it sounds like you were doing flips. Did you continue with that strategy of kind of a mixed, you know, rentals for cash flow and flips for like a bigger payday, if you want to call it that?
Yes, I would save my own money to buy rentals just for myself, but it was much easier to create partnerships for people who wanted that short-term return. Put some money in, or a contractor that would work for free and then needed that equity because he's been working for free for 6 months or a year or whatever. So that little partnership, we did, I want to say two, maybe three more deals after that. And we were so successful, like my contractor didn't need me anymore. He's like, I'm not splitting any more deals. I've got enough money. I don't need you, Alan, finding the deals. I don't need the girlfriend's dad. I ended up breaking up with the girlfriend. So I was like, I kind of felt bad asking her dad for more money, even though he was making money. And so that, yes, I became an opportunist. So I just started looking at things. Oh, what can I do with this property? And I like buying properties where I have options. So I'll go in every single property I buy and say, can I make money as a long-term rental? Because that's the path of least resistance. And if so, okay, I'm excited. Can I turn this into a short-term rental. I mean, back then, the short-term rentals didn't exist, but this is how I evaluate today. Yes, I can. Okay. And I can make more money. Okay, great. Now I have an option here. Can I flip this and make some money? Yes. And this is what it looks like. Can I rezone this? Can I add square footage to it? Can I house hack it? Like, I just want options. And if the other options don't work out, I can always go back to it being a long-term rental and profiting for me. So that's my lowest bar. Does it work as a long-term rental? And I like to have options on top of that.
I like that. I think about it the same way, kind of option A, B, C, and then worst case scenario is like, I move in and, you know, like I'm generally doing a renovation. So it's like doing a good job on the renovation. It's like, that's not the end of the world if I have to move into the place. So yeah, I like the options of different strategies. And that's what's great about real estate is that there are so many different ways you can approach it and still make money. I want to get into the books behind you. There's three different books behind you. When did the idea of writing a book come about? Tell me a little about that. Yeah. I'm very interested in the process of book writing and what gave you the confidence to do it.
Well, I wanted to be a comedy writer, right? So it lent itself well. I was already writing jokes every day. And when I wasn't writing jokes, I was devouring personal finance books. And I was like, these are all boring. These are all textbook. Right. And there is not a creative, there's not a funny, you know, real estate investing book or an entertaining personal finance book. And so I was like, I'm going to write one. And actually, I put it on my website that I was at a comedy website at the time, which was brand new, all in HTML. Wow, you know, exciting tech whiz that I was. And in my bio, I said, Alan's currently writing a book about personal finance and real estate investing, which I put on my bio as sort of a goal, as like, oh, I've put that out in the world. Now I got to follow through because I don't want to be a man of my word. And so when I was, it was a sort of synergy of events where I was on reality TV, Queer Eye just hit. I was in season one. I was made over. I was also on, which was like an hour long show of me being a real estate investor on the show, and they're making me over. And then I was also at the exact same time on a show called The Restaurant with Rocco DiSpirito, which was like a high-end restaurant where I was a waiter, and they were both airing on Bravo TV. And so and they aired back to back. So you would see me on Queer Eye for an hour. Immediately after, you would see me as a waiter. So I went from a real estate investor made over to back to being a waiter in a restaurant. And then the Barbara Corcoran thing hit the New York Times. And I was in, like, everyone's like, who the hell is this guy? Yeah. He's like a chameleon. And is he a waiter? Is he a real estate investor? Is he, you know, and so all those things, I was getting a lot of press all at once. And so luckily someone, a publisher, Random House, someone, an editor worked there, was following this. And there was, you know, there's actually petitions to get me off reality TV. I was trying to, like, people were really upset because I ruined the illusion of reality TV for them. And she reached out to me and said, hey, I'd like to see your book that you're writing that you talk about on your website. And I was like, oh, damn, I have not written that book. I was like, but I didn't say that. I was like, sure, let's meet in 2 weeks. And then so I threw everything together in 2 weeks and I brought it to her. And she was quite honest and was like, this is shit, Alan. I was like, yeah, I agree. But she's like, I like your attitude. I like your, you know, what you're doing. Let's work together. And that led to a book deal. And that first book was called $1 Million by 30. About I became a millionaire by 30. Actually, it took me 6 years. I started at 22 when I bought my first property. When I was 28, I became a millionaire. And that book came out when I was 30. So it's step by step. And I made it funny. I tried to make it funny. And when I realized as I was writing it, it's really hard to make personal finance advice funny.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I see why this doesn't exist. It's really difficult to do.
So at what stage of the game did you leave your tech support job and you went whole hog into real estate? How old were you at that point?
So it was a combination of things where I realized that if I had a job, it was easier for me to get mortgages, right? And so then instead of the job wasn't a vehicle for me to live and pay for my food. Like I got enough of that from my real estate. I lived off my cash flow of my real estate. And then I only used my job as a way to get mortgages. And then so that mind switch allowed me to tolerate going to a corporate job. Because then it was like, you think you're using me. I was like, no, I'm using you, right? You know, kind of thing. I was still doing the same work. I was still a good employee. I occasionally get raises and a small bonus of $2,000, $5,000 each year or whatever, but enough to get, you know, appreciate it. But the crash, what happened is 2008, 2009, everyone got let off everywhere. Like it was a tough time, right? And so I lost my job. And it was difficult for me to get mortgages, even if you had a job, because all the mortgage lenders were going under.
Exactly.
It was the time of like, you get a loan and you get a loan and you get a loan. And they were all, you know, paying the piper finally. So it was one of those things where I was bored and it was depressed. I couldn't do any deals. I'm a deal junkie, right?
Yeah,
right? Real estate deal junkie. And so that actually led me to my second book idea, where I was like, you know, the most I'd ever made in the corporate world was, I think, $65,000 if you add up all my bonuses and stuff during those 5 or 6 years of some raises. And I was like, you know what? I know I don't have the pedigree, but I want to be in the C-suite. You know, how fast can I recreate myself to get $150,000 salary? I was like, I just like goals and I like timelines.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I want to see if I can, in 5 years, create $150,000 salary from scratch. And so that's, if you want to get into my second book, The Subversive Job Search.
I assume you made the goal of 150,000. So what did you do to, what was your strategy? I'm interested to hear.
Yes. So what I did was, first, I went to all the job hunting sites at the time and copy and pasted all the job descriptions that I thought I could potentially, you know, turn into. Because I worked in tech support. I was like, I've got some experience. I don't want to do tech support. But so I was like, it's something computer related, maybe customer service related, those sort of two things. I was also did some project management, which really loosely defined what project management was, but there was a little bit there. And so I took all the jobs that were sort of in the C-suite that were sort of in these industries, these roles, and I put them in a Word cloud. And so just copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste, and then press the button in the Word cloud. What it does is the words that appear most frequently appear in a larger font, kind of thing. And so then I was just reverse engineering what I needed in my resume. And I was like, okay, now I know if I want these jobs, I have to have all these big words in the Word cloud in my resume. And so that was great. Now I had goals to reach and how fast could I get there? And quite often, many of them wanted an MBA, but a few of them, which I wasn't going to do and didn't have the money to do and didn't have the time to do. But I was like, okay, they want an MBA that has this sort of expertise. And I would find like online certificates or courses that were like a 3-week course or a 6-week course that were similar. So I could check that box, right? Like it wasn't an MBA, but you know, I could go get a project management designation, which was like a 6 weeks, you know, online course kind of thing. And so I just reverse engineered that way. I got really creative and would finesse what I was doing at tech support, right? Like, sure, I was answering tech support, but also if someone was implementing their software rollout, I had to create a plan that says, okay, we're going to do this week and the next week we need to do this. And I'm like, oh, now I've got project management experience, right? Oh, I was talking to, now I've got customer service. So I took my one job, which was tech support, and made it into 10 different roles that, so I could go down different alleyways, right? And so one thing led to another. So I got a new job. And because I didn't care about this job in that I knew I wasn't going to stay there I had a goal. So I got a job offer of $65,000, which was what I was making before. And then I just spent my entire time at my desk when I wasn't doing anything, applying for other jobs. And I would just, I didn't care what it was, as long as it was closer to $150,000. And what I realized is like, people weren't fact checking me. So when I'd go into an interview, I would be like, yeah, I make $85,000. The checks and balances may be better now, but, or you know, maybe I didn't get the jobs because they did do checks and balances. But I'd be like, I'm looking for a $100,000 job because I make 85. And they're like, oh yeah, we understand that. And they're like, sorry, Alan, we can't pay you $100,000, but we can pay you $87,000. And I'm like, okay, I'll take it. And so I just kept doing that. And so I didn't want to stay at a job for 2 years because I realized, and what I realized now as a business owner who has employees, is that I have a budget, right? I can only pay my employees so much. Mm-hmm. Even if you're a rock star or superstar, there is a time where maybe I can't pay you what you're worth. And I wish I could. And I understand you leaving because you can't, you are worth more than I can actually pay you.
Yep.
But if I do have it in my budget to pay you, then I will to keep you around. And so I would work really hard at my job and say, listen, I am got an offer for $87,000 over here. Can you match it? Because I've been busting my ass. And sometimes they would. And sometimes they wouldn't. Then they'd be like, we get it, Alan. We understand. You go take the money, right? And so I wasn't like burning bridges or anything like that. But then once I got that $87,000 job, every free moment was, how can I get a $90,000 job, right? Because most people get a 3% raise, 2% raise, you know, things like that. But it takes a whole year where that might happen. But I could get a $10,000 bump, a $15,000 bump in 6 months or in a year. That's so much better. And then what I realized is, you know, or what I wanted, I was like, once I hit $100,000, then I can kind of pick the job that's close to my house or has the perks that I want or, you know, something I'm interested in. Let me spend the next 2-3 years just getting up to the chain where now I can have options, but I think people get too picky about their jobs when they're early in their career. And I was just like, no, let's chase the dollar. Let's stay in the industry that I want to be in and get to the top. So spoiler alert, subversive job search. Yes, I eventually did it. I think it took me 2.5 years to get up there. And so I had recruiters. I worked with multiple recruiters, which are great. Their job is to go get me a job. And I'd be like, don't call me unless you have a job that's $125,000. But I'm not paying them anything. It's right. Like having a real estate agent. Like they get a commission if they can find me a job paid by the employer. And so I would utilize them. And I was just using every tactic that I could. Now that I'm older, if anyone really wants to go this route, what I realized is every company that I worked for, the salespeople, the best salesperson in every company made more than the CEO. And so
is that right?
If you want to make a lot of money, yeah, like because it's untapped commissions. Like, right. Go sell our product. The more ones you sell, you're going to get a commission. And so go sell something expensive because, you know, working in software, the people sell $100,000 software packages. I mean, they had boats and everything. And I was like, and they were dumb as rocks. Like, all they did was go out drinking with people. And I was like, I sort of pivoted into sales at the end because I was like, I can be dumb and I can go drink in with people, but it seems so much easier and more fun than being a CEO somewhere.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, the Range Rover Sport leads by example. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability, and combines assertive on-road performance with the signature Range Rover refinement that you'd expect. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, and redefines sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, which offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can also enjoy a dynamic drive in total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennial investing. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for public investing, 5.1% in APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. All right, back to the show.
That's funny. I like how you just gamified the whole process of job search and career advancement. It's pretty cool. So that one's called Subversive Job Search?
Yes, yes.
Cool. So I want to talk about the next one, House Fire. That, I think, is a brilliant name for a book. Talk to me, first of all, what FIRE is. There's some of our listeners that don't know that term that might be new to them. So get into that a little bit, and then we'll get into the book after that.
Sure, yeah. And House Fire, just like Subversive Job Search, just like $1 million by 30, meant to be entertaining and fun. But FIRE stands is an acronym and sort of a niche personal finance community that stands for Financial Independence and Retire Early. I didn't come up with FIRE. I would have come up with something way more creative than that, but it just doesn't really roll off the tongue. Financial Independence, Retire Early, but that's the FIRE movement that you may be seeing some press about or find some Reddit threads or whatever. And it's a strategy that is really when do you know you can retire? And this guy, the professor at Trinity University about 40 years ago, ran a bunch of Monte Carlo simulations and things and realized that if you have 25 times your annual expenses saved up in a stock portfolio, regardless of your timing, if you right after the stock market crash or right before you put all your money in, as long as you withdraw 4% of your stock portfolio of that 25x your annual expenses. So if $100,000 you're spending a year, 25x is that $2.5 million?
$2.5 million.
Yeah. So if you have $2.5 million in stocks, doesn't matter what's happening in the stock market historically, as long as you withdraw 4%, that's $100,000 and you can maintain your lifestyle. I didn't like that. I hated that because one, it was, yeah, of course, I got to save $2.5 million. I have options. Like that number was so ludicrous to me. I was like, yeah, I got to work for 30 years to get there
right.
And live the corporate life. Like that wasn't exciting. So yep. I was like, but I understood like living below your means. And so like a lot of it was, okay, well, don't live for $100,000,
yeah.
Walk everywhere or house hack so that your expenses are $80,000. And I didn't want to do that either because as I was growing older, I wanted a higher level of lifestyle.
Sure.
I think everyone does.
Yep.
No one wants to plateau or live below their means as they get older.
Keep eating ramen noodles. You wanted to move on from that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to start impressing girls finally, take them out on dates, kind of thing. Have them visit me. Kind of thing. So that, I had a problem with the FIRE movement because of that. And then also you're on a constrained budget in retirement, even with inflation, even though you're withdrawing that same 4%, whether it's $100,000 or whatever, it doesn't go as far. And so I just saw problems with it, but I felt like I was part of the FIRE community. So I was like, how can I make this real estate related? How can I improve this through real estate, which is the impetus of the book House FIRE. And so what I realized is if you take their formula that they teach that, let's say I have an internet bill or phone bill combo that's $150 a month. A year of that, that's $1,800. So 25 times that is $45,000. So in their methods, save up $45,000 and you can have internet for life, right? Like they love going to Costco and everything. And I can't go to Costco and buy internet access for life. Like you can't buy that in bulk. You can't prepay that. So this was the bill that's going to follow me forever. And I was like, it's going to take me forever to save $45,000 just to pay $150 bill. And so I was like, let's take half of that. And that's $22,500. I know I can go buy a property for $100,000. That's back in the day, but even today, I'm still buying properties for $100,000. And with 20% down on a $100,000 property, get an $80,000 mortgage, there's about $2,500 in closing costs. That's half of what I had saved for. If I do that, put in a property manager, put in tenants in, budget for repairs, CapEx, vacancies, my cash flow typically is $150. And so all of a sudden, that sort of with this by the House FIRE switch, where I was like, oh, all I need to do is save off for $22,500 and all that house will pay for that bill. And then, so then I was like, what's the next bill I have in my life that I hate? Okay. I hate my utility bills. So I can't get rid of those either. They're going to follow me for life. Let's add up the electric bill, the gas bill, all that. Okay. That water bill. Okay. That's about $150 a month. Let me save another $22,500. So this is my house FIRE method. I bought a house for every single bill in my life. And then that also took about 5 to 6 properties. I just say, my goal, gamify, let me save up $22,500. Let me save $22,000. And it became easier and easier because I had a house that was paying my bill, So you, that loop to save up another 20 became faster and faster. And so then I just started a house for every bill. And then you retire much faster. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I live larger in retirement because what eventually happens is your rent goes up a little bit. So I'm making a little bit more money. Eventually, let's say I had a house for a car note, right? A 5-year mm-hmm. car note. I could take, I want a Tesla. I could take $50,000 and go to the Tesla shop and hand it to the richest man in the world and say, let's exchange my money for your Tesla. And he said, that works for me. I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. How much is it going to cost for like a 5-year car note on a Tesla? I don't know. It was $500, for example, whatever it is. And I was like, okay, well, let me take my $50,000, go buy a house, put that as a down payment. that kicks off $500. And that way I get to keep my $50,000. That house pays for my car note. That car note, you know, that house pays the richest man in the world, not me. And then eventually in 5 years, when that car note's paid off, I now have $500 to go somewhere else. You know, that could go to my food bill or my vacation budget, right? So I had all these assets that would pay off my bills. And then eventually the mortgage would be paid off, or the note that what I earmarked it for was paid off. And then I could allocate it to another expense in my life. And that's another way. 5 years is really all it takes. If you kind of take this approach, most people, depending how large you live, to kind of siphon off your little segment off, burn up those bills with the house fire method. And so that's sort of what I teach in the book as well.
How many rentals would you say it takes on average to become financially independent, retire early? What would you say the number is?
So there's not a catch-all answer to that,
yeah.
But I would say roughly five. And so you don't have to be a mogul. You don't have to, you know, try to own 1,000 properties. If anything, five is going to change your life, and it's going to 5X your speed to retirement over the typical investing in stocks FIRE method.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I did the same kind of strategy, got to, I don't know how many rentals I had, but I got to the point where I had enough income to meet my expenses. And at that point, I said I was going to do something that I loved, which ended up working here at TIP and doing the podcast. So it really just gives you optionality. Once you hit those rentals and once those bills are paid for, it's like, you can then go do your comedy if you want, or you can pursue whatever dream, you know, that you want to do at that point. What do you think it is that keeps people, or what do you see that keeps people back from doing this? I think I've got several buddies that are in the trades that they talk all the time about investing in real estate, but they never do. So what is it in your experience that just holds people back from all of this?
A lot of it comes to analysis paralysis, where they want it to chase everything. And it's tough, because I say there's a million ways to make $1 million in real estate. You can make $1 million a year as a short-term rental host. You can make $1 million as a long-term rental host. You can make $1 million buying townhomes. You can make $1 million as a flipper, as a wholesaler. So people are constantly learning all the different strategies. And they're like, which one should I do? And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Pick one and just focus on one. Buy anyone's book. Well, I don't even care if you buy my book or someone else's book, but the blueprint is in those books. And they're not trying to lie to you. They're giving you the footprint. And it doesn't take away from me if you institute my strategies in your life, because there's so many deals around that even if you are my next door neighbor and you're doing the same thing, there's plenty of deals, because I physically can't buy them all. I don't have the time or the energy or the money, right? And so I'm an open book, you know, literally in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I don't care, just pick one and stick to it. And because I think people want to divert, they're all worried about diversity, diversifying their profile. And I think that's not what you should do, because you don't become an expert. If you've got a duplex, I'm looking at duplexes in Florida, and I'm looking at a short-term rental in my hometown, and then someone will come to me like, you know, I see an apartment building in Texas. They're like, which one should I buy? And I was like, well, have you looked at all the comps and everything? You're like, yeah, this is the best apartment building in Texas. This is the best one in my hometown. I was like, then buy them all, because you found the best of that product. But I can't tell you which one is better than the other. But you're going to scale, and scale is going to make your life easier if you just focus on one. Like if you become known as the condo queen in Manhattan and only you buy condos, what happens is the neighbors tell you, oh, you buy condos here. Oh, you know what? I heard my friend Susie at a happy hour buys condos, and the deals start finding you once you sort of have that expertise and branded. And so like I have like four quads on the same street. And quadruplexes. And I bought one, and then a real estate agent is like, Alan, I heard you bought a condo on that street. Do you want to buy this one I'm about to list? Yeah. And then the neighbor's like, oh, you bought those two? Well, yeah. I'm going to sell mine. You know, do you want to buy mine? Sure. And then all of a sudden, I didn't tell anyone. It just sort of happened where Alan buys four quadruplexes in this zip code. And I ended up buying them all. Like, because they came found me. And those deals are so much better than having to fight. And so, and then once I also realized it's easier to manage, because I don't have to create different teams. You know, leveraging money is one thing to get wealthy, but leveraging teams is the other thing you have to do. And so my contractor on my luxury A properties is not the same contractor I use on my Section 8, you know, government housing properties. I could, but they don't know whether to buy linoleum floors. Like, I've never had to do this before. They don't know how to install it, right? And so when I was trying to diversify, I had to recreate my contractors. I had to have different property managers, because different property managers are in certain city limits and things like that. Now that I've scaled up and I've been doing this for 25 years, sure, diversified. But in your first five, if you're going for that one a year for 5 years for an early retirement, the house fire method, or even the $1 million by 30 method, then yes, I think you should focus on one area. Because then when you look at a property, you can be like, you can't rent a two bedroom for that because I own 3 2 bedrooms and I don't get that for rent, right? Or this is labeled incorrectly. Like you're going to recognize the deals and the flaws so much faster because that is the lane that you swim in. And it's so much easier to be successful that if you kind of create that niche for yourself.
Yeah, it's a really good point. There's a guy that I interviewed, Sean O'Dowd is his name, that he just focuses on one zip code. That's it. One zip code. And he knows literally probably knows every house within that zip code. And he becomes the guy, exactly like you said. Like, it's in a really expensive school district, really good schools. Yeah. That's where he's focused. And now he's kind of become this guy that buys in this school district and does rentals for like longer term, 3 years or 4 years for people that want to be in that school district for their kids for a good education.
Yeah. And you're cutting out all the noise of anything that's not in that school district. And which is great is I'm the opposite of Sean. I would never invest in a good school district. Yeah. So he found a way to make money. I teach not to buy a good school districts because you're paying a premium price and it's hard. You know, sure, you're going to get long-term tenants, but your cash flow is usually not as good because it's more expensive to buy the properties in a good school district. And a 10 school district can only stay at 10 or go down. But if I buy in a 7 school district, it has the opportunity to go to 8 or a 9, and then I make a lot of money that way. So it doesn't mean don't do it. He found his strategy that works for him. I found a strategy that works for me. And when you have a niche yourself, you're going to find a strategy that works for you.
Good points. I want to talk a little bit about what your portfolio looks like today. Where are you focused? Where are you concentrated? Where are you seeing opportunities? What are you focused on today?
Yeah, so I have only multifamily properties in Atlanta by myself, about 18 doors, mostly quads and triplexes and some duplexes. And then with some partners, we bought into a couple apartment complexes, another 350 doors. And those are all sort of in town, Atlanta, and in Huntsville, Alabama. And so I live here and I feel like I'm an expertise. My expertise is here, but I have invested in New York City. That's where I got started. Charleston, South Carolina. I love college towns. And it just happens that I've 1031 and sold some properties and moved my portfolio closer to me. Too many frozen pipes happening in New York City. So I don't have to deal with that in Atlanta, but now I have to deal with termites. So I've just swapped one problem for another.
But you liquidated all of your holdings in New York?
Yes. And I mean, because when I moved on Murder Avenue, right? Like it was all 99 cent stores, bodegas in Brooklyn. I say every property that you buy comes with imaginary lottery tickets. So I buy every property for that, but the house fire method, just what bill will this pay for?
Right.
And then Brooklyn changed over the 10 years that I owned there. The Brooklyn Nets came to town. The bodegas turned into Chipotle's. The 99 cent stores turned into Starbucks. Mm-hmm. And I sold my properties that no one wanted to live in, you know, 10 years later to celebrities. You know, Christina Ritchie, the Wednesday, actress played Wednesday, bought one of my properties. And, you know, the mayor's right-hand man became a tenant in another one of my properties. So like, really distinguished people started moving into the neighborhood, and I didn't plan on that.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the imaginary lottery ticket that comes with real estate investing. You buy for the basics, and you may get super lucky. And both those two of these townhomes that I bought in Brooklyn, I sold for $2 million each, and I bought one for $450,000, and I bought one with 100% financing for $1 million, and sold it a couple of years later for $2 million. So I had $1 million payouts just because of these imaginary lottery tickets, but I bought them for the minuscule cash flow that would cover a bill in my life.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when you talk about the basics, you're primarily buying for the cash flow. And then if there's appreciation, that's just, you view it as just bonus upside, right?
Yeah, because I can't control that. And that's like the speculative, like everyone's like, oh, Alan got lucky, but you know, I didn't try to get lucky. I was like, it wasn't like, let me lose money each month. Let me break even all my months because I think the property values are going to go up. You know, I can't control that. So it doesn't even factor into when I'm purchasing a property. If I could control that, it felt, you know, investing in stocks, I can't control that. So why even spend my time thinking about it?
I wanted to talk a little bit about debt and leverage. I saw a tweet that you had that you said, never pay off long-term fixed rate debt. Talk to me a little bit about that and your thoughts on leverage.
Yeah. So Dave Ramsey and I would probably have a really good debate on this if he would be open to it. But I see where he's coming from. But I am definitely anti pay off your mortgage early. And an example, what I realize now, you know, I was in that mindset because I grew up on Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman and these talking heads, pay off your mortgage, pay off your mortgage. So I thought that was the goal, to get a 15-year mortgage. And so I did that. And I learned every single time I did that, it was a mistake. So now if I have a paid off house, I can't sleep at night. And so some people are like, I want to pay off my mortgage so I can sleep at night. I was like, well, if you really understand how money works, you would not sleep at night. And the way I illustrate this is, imagine that you pull into a gas station today and you find a dollar on the ground. You pick it up and you have two options. You listen to what Dave Ramsey says and pay off your mortgage early. Let me take that dollar, mail it into the bank and get a dollar off your principal. Or if you're sort of don't have those long-term goals, you're going to treat yourself and go into the gas station, buy a dollar Snickers bar, mm-hmm. right? Pull in one of two camps. Are you going to be the prudent financial person, or are you going to, you know, you might die tomorrow, so let's go get that Snickers bar today. So you do that, right? Now, let's say the you didn't pick up that dollar and you came back to that gas station 15 years later, but that dollar was still there. So 15 years later, you pull back in, no one's picked up that dollar yet. Fine, I'm going to get out of my car and pick up that dollar. We're in a cashless society. I'll find a way to spend this dollar. And so you have two options. You can go into the gas station, go get your Snickers bar, but hold up, you can't, because that Snickers bar is $3 now, right? So you that purchasing power is worthless in 15 years. But you can still mail that in to your bank and get a full dollar off your principal, right? So it's got triple the purchasing power of your mortgage, because that is a fixed rate mortgage for 30 years expense that's not going to change when everything around you is constantly changing. The price is always going to go up.
Yep.
It's called inflation. It's just, it's inevitable. Why would you get rid of that benefit? The best benefit you have is a 30-year expense. The largest expense of your life is your mortgage, most likely. Why would you get rid of that benefit that's locked for 30 years? It doesn't make sense. Everything around you is going to get more expensive. Buy that now. Buy all the Snickers now, because they're going to be more expensive. You know, hoard Snickers. It's so much. That's a better investment than paying off your mortgage.
I want to hear a little bit. You focused obviously on real estate, but do you look outside into other asset classes for your portfolio at all? Or are you just strictly focused on real estate?
Well, I call myself a real estate maximalist. I try to solve every problem with real estate. I try to do everything through real estate. I have at times bought individual stocks. I've done some mutual funds. I've done crypto. And then every single time I'm like, let me get into this. And I do all the research. I find a property that I can't buy unless I sell all my crypto and I sell all my stocks and my mutual funds to go buy real estate. So I get in the cycle where I try to, but I just get sucked back into real estate because that's my expertise. I love it. And it's treated me well for 25 years. And I now preach the gospel and I'm an evangelist. I'm trying to convert everyone else who's not doing real estate to do more real estate.
My dad says something similar where he's like, you make money in your own business and you inevitably often lose it when you try to venture outside of your circle of competence. And that's totally my experience. Like, focus on what you know, stay in your lane, focus on your circle of competence and won't deviate from your strategy.
Yeah, I just don't have the patience to wait. Like, I understand it works. I know historically it works. But if I have like a day off, I can go improve my property. But if I have a day off, I can't improve my crypto. Yeah. Like, I can't improve my stocks. Like,
that's right.
I just feel like I'm sitting idle and I'm like, I hope someone else is working extra on the weekend on the stock. You know, it just drives me insane.
I want to talk a little bit about House Money Media. It's a new venture that you've got going. Talk to me about it. Tell us about it and why you decided to partner up with Lauren from Adulting is Easy.
Yeah. So I didn't have a real estate mentor. I didn't have any rich, you know, mentors, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast here. And so I wanted to be that. I wanted to create a company for that. And I, you know, my niche is mostly small multifamilies, long-term rentals. I see other people online who are teaching short-term rentals, and that's Lauren's niche. And so I was like, we're chasing the same audience. You want to teach these folks and you want to be a mentor. They have a lot of questions. I have some short-term rentals, but I don't have as many reps in as Lauren does. And so I was like, why don't we combine forces and be the mentors for these people and create, you know, we've got courses, we've got podcasts, newsletters, I blog, I still get my creative writing, try to make them funny, try to make them entertaining, just like my books. This is all at housemoneymedia.com. And you can sign up and be in our private Discord where you can post your deals and Lauren and I will chime in, tell you our thoughts. and bring you on the podcast or whatever it is, try to change people's life. Typically, you know, first generation real estate investor. I'm a first generation real estate investor. I had no one, and I want to be the person, you know, so to save someone having to read 50 books in the library, like I've done that. Let me just regurgitate what I've learned and 25 years of experience, and let me hold your hand and make your life easier and you'll be more successful so you can change your life like I have. I just, you know, try to give back at this point.
That's awesome. That's what's so great about today is that there's so many resources out there that whereas like 25 years ago, you had to go to the library. There was nothing to listen to. There was, you know, no interviews to listen to. It's just like the times are so much better now in terms of learning what you want to learn. You guys are producing a ton of content. I mean, you mentioned a newsletter, podcast, courses. How do you guys manage all that? It's tough to pump out that much content.
Well, we all left our day jobs because of real estate. So when we're not looking at deals, we're not doing real estate deals. That's we create content. And honestly, it's like a diary entry. Like, what did I do today? Yeah. Okay. Well, this could be a learning lesson for someone. Let me put it out there.
That's awesome. Alan, this has been a lot of fun. I really have enjoyed your time. It's fun to talk about the books that you've written and your journey to financial independence using real estate. How can our listeners find out more about you, find out about House Money Media, just all that you're up to?
Yeah, well, I'm on social media, Real Estate Maxi. I'll also go to housemoneymedia.com. That's where our blogs and podcasts, you know, search up the House Money Media podcast. And, you know, you're going to find me talking about real estate. If you find me in the bar, I'm going to trap you and talk about real estate. The reason I have a podcast, the reason I write about real estate is everyone in my life is sick of me talking about real estate. So now I have to talk real estate to strangers.
I love it. Alan, thanks a lot for your time. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Patrick.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.